So at what point did you phone him back? Or
I phoned him, after the rape happened in October 92, in that next spring when I started getting all these weird nightmares and flashbacks. I remembered Martin Orne.
So you remembered him as one of your so-called good doctors.
Doctors, right. So I called him, and I had his home number. I called him, and he said, had I called Dr. Heath? I said, yeah, but he wants me to come back for more electroshock treatments. And he said, well, that's what you need to do. I said, well, why did you do those things to me? I mean, I remember you. You were so mean. And he said he never did anything to hurt me. And he was just there as a consultant, and he just talked to me. And he swore up and down he never did anything to hurt me. And then I heard, after we got back from Washington testifying, I heard that he had a stroke. And that he's still, paralyzed from the stroke, I think. So,
And what about Dr. Robert Heath? What specifically was he involved? What aspects of the...
He's a neuropsychiatrist. He's the head of the department at Tulane. It was his department that was given the money, the grant money. He was also given a whole... Mr. Fenner, who was chairman of the board of Tulane Medical School, gave him a whole wing of the medical school just to use for experiments. And they were just a lot of children, I remember. We weren't allowed to talk to each other, or even we weren't even supposed to see each other, but you could hear them sometimes, and you'd stay on this wing where there weren't any nurses, really. It was just like orderlies and the doctors. But it wasn't like a regular hospital, like with nurses that came in to see you. You had monitors in your room. They watched you. I'm pretty sure they had a camera in the room. And Dr. Heath was the head of the department there, and he also was known for doing a lot of work on brains, and experimenting on people's brains. And he was the one who wanted to put an implant in my brain so that he could telegraph, he said, messages to me when I was doing the entrapment things with men, that he could stimulate different parts of your brain or something, and he could do it by remote, he didn't call it remote, he said by, he could access my brain from a distance, but he had to implant a box in your head.
So would you say he was the main doctor in charge of what happened to you, or?
Yes, he was considered my doctor, like on record. I had to have a record, a chart at Tulane, under the name Crystal Stone. And he was Crystal Stone's doctor of record. You know, if you looked under... Of course, he's now removed my records when I called him the first time and said, what did you do to me? I mean, I'm having these memories, and I thought you were my doctor back then. I thought you... My mother had brought me to Tulane because Mr. Fenner told her, well, I think they can help her at Tulane, because I was having behavioral problems at home when I was real little. This was before Deep Creek Lodge and all that, before I was 8 years old. She said I was acting out, and I was crying a lot and wetting the bed and stuff like that. And so Mr. Fenner suggested that she bring me to Tulane to see this Dr. Heath. And that's how I met him, was with my mother. And she signed papers giving him permission to do anything that he saw necessary to help me. So he had free reign to do anything he wanted to me with my mother's permission. And of course he never, he would call and tell her, well, Claudia needs to come in for a treatment. Bring her in, or, have somebody bring her in. And she just dropped me off in the front of the building. I'm just 6 or 7 years old. She dropped me off this big, huge hospital, and I'd have to go in and take the elevator up, and the woman would come get me and take me to the room. And, I would be there for days, sometimes weeks. And then the next thing I knew, I'd wake up one morning, and Dr. Heath would be standing there, and he'd say, well, how are you feeling, dear? Fine. Well, you ready to go home? You're cured. And He would tell me that I was much better and that I wasn't going to misbehave anymore, and I wouldn't have any clue as to what happened to me while I was there. I would just wake up with no memory of it, and he would tell me that I'd been good and obedient and it was time to go home. So he'd send me home, and then he'd call my mother if I had, like, bruises or anything that had to be explained, and he would give her some explanation as to how they happened. Or if I was bleeding, he would tell her that they had to do an examination or something, a test, and that it made me bleed. I mean, she didn't really question anything. I don't think she really cared. She didn't want to know.
And what about Morse Allen, you mentioned? From what you remembered, what was his involvement?
He was from he was with the department that was called Science and Technology. And I think Orne at one time was the head of that. Martin Orne was the head of the Science and Technology Department. And he was with ORD, something called ORD, Office of Research and Development. And Morse Allen was like the head of that. And it was research on a whole bunch of different things. But I know he had a lot to do with radiation, because I heard him talk about it. But he also worked with the projects involved with me. I remember him pretty much from the beginning, from 1958 to sometime in high school, and then I don't remember him anymore.
And what about L. Wilson Green, you also mentioned?
Now, he, next to Heath, I guess he had the most authority, or whatever you want to call it. He was a German doctor. Liam was his first name, but he hated being called anything but Dr. Green. And he was head of Edgewood Arsenal. Or that's where his office was, Edgewood Arsenal, in Fort Detrick, Maryland. But he came to Tulane quite a bit and worked with Dr. Heath on the projects. And he told me, or he told, when I was about 14 or 15, he told me the story. He told one of my shadows the story that how he got involved. And he said that he was in a concentration camp because he was Jewish. And he had been in the concentration camp when the war ended. And the Nazis had killed his sister, put him in a concentration camp, and he had met the Angel of Death there, and that was his hero. And he used to love to watch him do experiments on twins and everything, and I didn't know who the Angel of Death was. I didn't even know who that was, but it turned out it was Mengele. And Dr. Green said that when he was 15, no, he was put in the camp when he was 15, I don't know how long he stayed, but when the war ended, the United States paid to bring him to back, our government paid to bring him back to the United States and put him through medical school, and now they paid him to do these experiments. And he said, so your government pays for me to do things to you. And he was real, you know, he thought our government was full, you know, they were made up of fools, that everybody was a fool. That they were stupid. But he said he got paid by them, so, and they're the ones who got him out of the camp.
So what you're saying is it seems that L. Wilson Green, although a victim at the concentration camps under Mengele, had somehow associated himself.
He'd gotten in good with Mengele, but
helped with the experiments?
In the experiments they were doing. And so he sort of became like, he wasn't really a prisoner anymore. I guess he was more like he worked like his assistant almost. Even though he was Jewish, I guess he showed a lot of, I don't know, morbid interest in what they were doing. And anyhow, this was his story. I don't know that it's even true. told me this. I don't think he's ever told anybody else. I mean, I think he told everybody different things. This is the story he told me. He didn't really talk about himself. He didn't seem to have any private life. He never talked about a wife or children. He seemed to always be traveling from one place to another. I never even knew where he stayed when he was in New Orleans until years later I found out he stayed at the Camp Nichols. I thought he lived at the hospital because he was always there.
Were any of the doctors involved in sexually abusing you while this experimentation was going on?
Yes. A lot of them were. Most of them took advantage of the fact that, you know, as long as they were there, they had access, they would, you know, do whatever they wanted. One of the few that didn't was Gottlieb, and I was told because it was kind of a joke that was going around that he only liked little boys, and so I guess that's why he didn't want anything to do with me. Martin Orne did, though. Dr. Green did a couple of times. Dr. Brown. And, of course, a lot of the agency men, they did. Hamilton, he was a horrible man. James Hamilton, he was from California, I think. Stanford, I think. Stanford, or I don't know. He was from California, and he was involved in projects that had to do with deviant sexual behavior. And he every time he got a chance, he would. From the time I was 8 years old until, you know, in my 20s, he took advantage of it. They even had a tape of him. He didn't seem to really care, though.
What kind of other people were you forced to have sex with in terms of blackmailing? And what were their backgrounds?
Military people. They had these people called the inspector generals that came around. And they would go around the country looking at different places that they were doing these projects. And they would determine whether the money was being well spent or not. So one of the ways, I guess, they would convince them that the money was being used well was by offering them, you know, whoever they wanted. And so I remember a couple of... They usually wore uniforms. They were usually in the military. And they were inspectors. And I would say, the inspector's coming, you know, you better be nice to him. You better do whatever he wants. And they always took advantage of you. One was the man with the wings on his jacket, I remember. He was a colonel, and he wore a uniform. I guess he was in the Air Force. I guess that's why he had wings on his jacket. And he was one of the inspectors that came. And then there was an admiral that came, and he was an inspector. So that was mainly the military men. They were either present at... They used to have these things that, like, when I went to Texas a few times, went to this place called Trims, T-R-I-M-S, and I remember it had the words on the outside of the gate, and I remember R was for research, and T was for Texas, and I was brought there, and they would put on these, not shows, but I guess they had to show... A lot of people, like military, agency people, and other doctors, they had to have to show what progress they were making in the projects. And so they would present different subjects that were being used and show what, you know, what they were able to accomplish. And you'd have to get in front of this audience of people. It was like an auditorium. And they did things like... They could create. One of the things they could do was, like, when you split, sometimes you can actually cause anesthesia in your body by splitting off that part, and you don't feel the pain at the time that it's happening, but you feel it later. Mm. And they would do things that would cause a lot of pain, but obviously weren't causing pain at the time. And everybody would ooh and ah over that because it was like something really that they had never seen before. And this was how they were proving they were using the money they were being given. I mean, they had to show people that they were, you know, that they weren't just spending it on, you know, hotel rooms and food and stuff. I guess they had to show that they were actually doing research. And I remember that distinctly in Texas, having that thing done, where they would inflict pain and you wouldn't feel it. You could, you know, they'd put you in a trance, like under hypnosis, tell you that you couldn't feel this part of your body, and then they would put a lit candle on it. And you wouldn't feel anything. But later on, you'd feel the burn. You know, it was like a demonstration. And I think it was an Air Force base that I was at. And I guess people would fly into. And I wasn't the only one. It was like a whole line of people waiting to go in, and we all had gowns on, like hospital gowns. And Dr. Heath and Dr. Green brought me in, and they would talk to the audience and say what they were going to do. And then,
now, I wonder if we can talk about the specific programs that that you believe that you were involved in, that you might have overheard. I know you mentioned MK Ultra. In terms of your experience, what was MK Ultra about, and maybe we could go through some of the other objects.
Well, it was my understanding that this is how it was kind of explained to me, not really explained, but as I overheard them talking about it. Back during the Second World War, when they started all this research stuff, and they had a project called Bluebird, and but they had to change the name because there was another branch of the government that was doing something called Bluebird, so they changed it to Artichoke, the big A, they would call it, and they were trying to create amnesia, and I think they were going to use it on soldiers, but they had to test it on people first. And there was a professor that was doing it, and I never met him or anything. I just heard them talk about him. Anyhow, this eventually became MK Ultra. And MK Ultra was like the generic name for all the projects went under MK Ultra. A lot of them did. You know, most of them did. And MK was supposed to stand for mind control. I know the spelling isn't right, but
it would be the correct spelling in using the German word control.
Okay, well, maybe Dr. Green thought of that. Mm. And Ultra was because it was ultimate in mind control. And so they would call a project like, let's say, one time I went to Mexico City briefly to get filmed with a person there, and it was 128, they called it. MKUltra 128. And then it would be subproject 18. And I was subject number 3. I mean, because after an experiment was over, Dr. Heath or whoever was in charge of it, and most of the time it was Dr. Heath because he was like in charge of me, would have to sit down and dictate, you know, like doctors do, they dictate to a machine their notes about a case, you know, after surgery or something. You know how doctors do that? Well, they had to do the same thing because it had to go on record into the CIA files. And then every now and then I would sit there and listen. I was supposed to be either sleeping or resting or something, and of course not paying attention, but I would be listening, and that part of me that had the photographic memory would be memorizing what they were saying. And he would go into this long, detailed explanation of the project that they had just done. And then every now and then he would say the word delete. Like he would say, MK Ultra, July 63 in Mexico City, delete. And that meant delete the last thing that he said, because sometimes they didn't want to give too much detail. And then there were other projects that I weren't involved in, but I overheard them talking about, like MK Naomi, and that had to do with drugs that they used to do different things to soldiers, like they were going to use it on the enemy. And it caused the K problem, they called it, which was paralysis. I would hear, like, Operation Secret was under MK Ultra, and that was a project. And it had to do with the brain.
Were there any other project names that you
recall? MK Search.
And what did that involve?
Some of that was had to do, sounded like, with biologicals or bacteria, you know, like, I guess it was germ warfare. And some to do with radiation. MK Ultra, like, subproject number 3 was to do with safe houses that they used, which were places like the Roosevelt Hotel here in New Orleans. It was a place that they kept all year round, and they had cameras, and it was someplace safe to, I guess, that they could use and not worry about anybody finding out about it. Anything to do with hypnosis or radiation or electricity came under the Office of Research and Development. And Martin Orr was technical science director, I think, of that department for a long time. Operation Chatter had to do with giving drugs and making you talk. Like, I guess, you know, trying different drugs out that would make them, they could get soldiers to, you know, capture enemy soldiers and make them talk. They called it chatter.
What would you like to see done to help yourself and other survivors that have gone through this?
I'd like to see us validated by opening up whatever CIA files remain classified. And I feel like a lot of the information I've given will be there. I know that my name exists in the files because I actually saw it on a file that was in 1964. I had access to a file that was left out in a room, and my name was on there. I mean, Crystal Stone, not Claudia, but Crystal Stone was on there. And it was something that was to be, you know, it was a memo that was going to be sent to the director. And so I have a feeling that even though they destroyed a lot of the files, that there'll be some left, and possibly with my name or other facts that people have given, and it'll be validation. And even though these people can't be prosecuted for it, I want the president to acknowledge the fact that it happened and that something should be done about it.
And what do you see, how do you see this coming about? The one element is declassifying the files that are still left.
Right. I think they should have another commission, this time on mind control, specifically on mind control. They've just had a committee, an investigation of the Tuskegee, those experiments.
Right.
And there's supposed to be another commission that President Clinton is opening on other CIA stuff. So I think I'd like to see him have a committee specifically for mind control and looking in the CIA files for mind control, especially done on children. Because that's the most horrible part of all this, is that they did this to children. It wasn't just unwitting citizens that got hurt. I mean, they did this to little kids. They did these horrible things to children, and they didn't think anything of it.
And
I didn't feel any guilt or remorse about it. I know that.
From what you remember, what's your sense of how many other children were involved?
Well, I'm sure there was thousands and thousands. I mean, just from the amount of children I saw that summer at Deep Creek Lodge in Maryland, I mean, there must have been 75 kids there. And you can imagine if that's just one time that I went, how many other kids were involved. And every time they went, if they saw 75 kids, and multiply that times all over the country, I mean, we must be talking about thousands and thousands, and all these kids are grown up now. And I think we should be acknowledged that it did happen to us and that it shouldn't have happened, and make sure that it's not happening anymore. How do we know that they're still not doing things like this?
Have you been in contact with other survivors throughout?
Yes, in contact all the time, through the internet. I meet them at conferences.
And when did you start getting in contact with other survivors?
Right after Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I didn't really have... I was just mainly involved in my own therapy, and that was the first contact I had with any other survivors, was in Washington, D.C., and since then, it's been constant contact with people. Because there were similarities, like they would have some similar things that happened to them that I had talked about, or just the fact that there's a lot of us that were adopted that were used in these experiments. And I'm sure there's a reason for that. I mean, I think there's an inordinate amount of children that were adopted that were used.
What would you want or expect as an outcome if hearings were held on mind control experiments?
I want the president to acknowledge, to come out and tell the world that this did happen, that the government was behind it, that they paid for it, that our tax dollars paid for it. I don't expect much in compensation as far as money. I mean, that's not why I'm doing it. I don't know if there'll be any money, but that's not the point. The point is that people need to know that what our government is capable of doing, what they did, and they should own up to it. Even though most of the people, you can say, well, most of them are dead, you know, so what's the point of going into all this? But we need to acknowledge that this kind of thing can happen, has happened, document it, so that it never happens again, and so that people aren't living in a dream world where your government doesn't do things like this, you know, not in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Things like this don't happen, but they do, and they did. And people need to know that.
What can people that are listening that may want to help further progress on getting hearings started?
Write to the White House, to the President, to Mrs. Clinton. If they have a computer, you can email them directly. They have an email address. If everybody... were to write and demand that there be hearings on mind control experiments done on children, I think they would have to listen if enough people, especially victims, children that are grown up now that were victims, if they come forward and you know, say that I want this looked into. The files have to be opened. They have to be allowed to for everyone to see what's in them. There's no reason to keep them classified anymore. I think they need to contact their senators, congressmen, and keep after the president until something's done.
Claudia, I'd like to thank you very much for joining and being part of this radio series. I know I consider it extremely brave of you to come forward with your experiences that you've remembered and of these horrific experiments that are inexcusable. I think people do have to make the government accountable for what they have done.
Yes, thank you, and I definitely agree. And I'd be glad to talk to anybody that, you know, that wants to contact me through the internet.
Did you want to give out an email address?
My email address is cmullen, cmullen, at, I mean 267, cmullen267 at aol.com.
Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you, Wayne.
We've been listening to an interview with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of U.S. government mind control. And the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control has produced a video letter of statements from mind control survivors demanding an investigation into mind control, which has been sent to President Clinton and Prime Minister Chrétien. You can send faxes, email, and letters of support for a commission of inquiry into the mind control experiments on children to Prime Minister Chrétien and President Clinton. Next week, the International Connection will be preempted to bring you Here and Queer, CKLN's Pride Week.